Yes, we've reached our final panel and it promises to be a cracker on the topic of global deregulation and simplification, which brings together, I reckon, several of the topics we've been chatting about today and really over the last couple of days. To help us unpack this, we've got a great panel. Will you please welcome to the stage Joe Longo, Chair of ASIC, Nicola Wakefield-Evans, Non-Executive Director at Viva, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and Sonic Healthcare, Joe Masters, Chief Economist at Barrenjoey, and Professor Graham Samuels from Monash University. Thanks, everybody, and thanks for sticking with us after lunch. Joe, we've almost done it.
Almost.
Okay. Let's have some fun.
One thinks of church. The beginning of the end.
I'm going to start with you. Our, the name of our panel is interesting. Global deregulation and simplification. And I just want to start by trying to unpack the differences between those two concepts. Deregulation sounds good. Simplification sounds good. What are we trying to get at? Is there an important distinction there?
Yeah, well, when I think of simplification or deregulation, it's not an excuse to be simplistic. So when I think about regulatory simplification, certainly from ASIC's perspective, anyone who's dealt with this over the years knows there was room for improvement. Mm-hmm. You know, statutory instruments couldn't be found. There were too many forms. It made no sense. You couldn't lodge them with us sufficiently. There was a lot of work to be done with the registries, which we're actually well on the way to doing now since they came back to us last year. So I think the first point about it is it starts with the regulators. So even when I met with Paul Atkins in earlier this year, I met with him twice, with the SEC chair, we talked about all the interesting stuff, which has come up a lot. But the other thing I was taken about with my meeting with him, one of his priorities is to modernise the SEC itself, to actually revisit their systems, technology. So this is there's that story. Yep. And then in terms of deregulation, I think is an unhelpful word. I would say, because I think most people, most of the time, who are thoughtful, will say regulation is part of our lives. You know, it plays a critical role in a civil society. What people don't like, and certainly business don't like, is a complex, burdensome, unnecessary regulation where the benefits don't seem so obvious, and certainly the costs seem to exceed the benefits. Mm. And as I've said repeatedly in recent times, we've got to own up to that now. It's been going on for too long. I mean, right from the 90s, people were writing articles about the complexity of Australian law, and it's just got worse. Judges don't like it. Law reform commissioners don't like it. Business doesn't like it. We don't like it. It makes our law enforcement efforts really awkward. So we need to get a grip of this now. Deregulation is not no regulation. It's all about better regulation that's easier to administer and encourages, you know, productivity, innovation, all the things we've been talking about.
Thanks, Joe. Nicola, you've worked across the economy in lots of different sectors across your career. Do you feel the weight of regulation has got heavier over time? And I guess the other side of that is, are we getting a dividend from that regulation as we should hope for?
So, really good question. I just wanted to go back just on the distinction between deregulation and simplification, because I see the two as completely different. They can be complementary. So deregulation, in its simplest terms, is removing regulation. Simplification is making existing regulation simpler, easier to navigate, easier to use. And, you know, the work that I've done with ASIC over the last 12 months has been a really good example of that. Mm. And if you look at the whole question of regulation and what we should do with it, you should keep in mind those two separate concepts. Yes, I do. The answer to your question is yes, there has been a massive increase in regulation in Australia. You know, I'm a lawyer in a previous life, and then I've been a company director now for 15 years. And in my 15 years on boards, regulation has increased substantially, particularly in some sectors. Financial services, definitely. But if you go across to, you know, one of the biggest issues we need to solve in this country is building more residential housing. Mm. The construction sector in this country is shocking in relation to regulation. You know, it's duplicative between three layers of government. for example, if you want to get a licence in one state to just be an electrician, you need to get another licence if you want to go to another state. It's ridiculous. Mm. So, yes, we have far more regulation, and the question is, has that served us well? I think in some areas, yes, in protecting consumers and protecting parts of the economy, but I think it's become unbalanced.
Yeah. I remember that they said a little while ago they're going to stop adding to the National Building Code for 4 years. I think it's still 1,000 pages or something,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Incredible. It'll be a great doorstop somewhere. Graham, you've been on both sides of the fence, of course, as a regulator and a business person. Not to get too philosophical here, but is there a key problem? Everyone howls for deregulation, and then when something goes wrong, we say, oh, we need some better regulation or more regulation. Is that the trap we're in?
Yes, in part, but I've got seven principles, so you'll have to bear with me. I do hope Gina's not still here because she'll be a bit annoyed if she hears some of the things I'm going to say.
She's always watching, Graham.
Don't ask. So first thing is, do not ask regulators to undertake market studies. Now, Ian Harper said this in 2014. Successive treasurers from Joe Hockey through to Morrison through to Frydenberg, and I think less so now Jim Chalmers, I think he's learnt the lesson, failed to take heed of that advice. So don't ask them to, because there's one fundamental rule you'll always know. Ask a regulator, do they want more regulations to regulate? They say, of course. Right, they'll always do it. So it's not in their culture. The regulator's role is to enforce the law, and it is the role of some other body, preferably, I think, we've got the perfect body, that is the Productivity Commission, to do policy advice and policy analysis. Now, let me just give you a couple of examples of where I think it fundamentally has failed. And I'm going to focus on the ACCC. Rod Sims was a great one. He's a policy wonk, and he loved to do policy analysis. So he persuaded, I think it was first Morrison and then following that was Frydenberg, to ask the ACCC to do digital services inquiry. It has got to be some of the worst policy stuff that you've ever seen come out of a regulator for some time. And if we, God forbid, follow its advice, then we will destine ourselves to become the backwater of artificial intelligence and the development of digital technology in much the same way as Europe has done. I'm reminded of Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor of the Exchequer of the United Kingdom, who turned around and she said, regulate for growth, don't just regulate for risk. And I think it's a fundamental lesson to be telling our regulators. By the way, the other one with the ACCC, and I've yet to find anyone who has thought their supermarket review of 12 months to look at presumably excessive or price gouging was of any value at all. So in that 411-page review, half a page said, we don't know what excessive pricing is, but we're not going to try and find out either. We just don't think it's occurring. Well, that was a great review for 12 months. I have to say to you, I was watching some of the interviews and of the witnesses, and Leah Wickett was in the witness box, and the KC that was questioning her said this, Miss Wickett, what's the purpose of a loyalty scheme? Oh my God, I thought, I held my head in embarrassment. My six-year-old grandson who was sitting beside me rolled his eyes and said, for heaven's sake, Pop, you know, what are they asking stupid questions like this for? What's the purpose of a loyalty scheme? So there you go.
Is that principle one?
That's principle one. Now the following ones are much quicker. So regulation, if you're going to limit regulation or remove regulations, it's a qualitative issue, not a quantitative issue. People who say we're going to remove 15% or 20% or 30% have got no idea what they're talking about. It is really dealing with the quantitative issues. Focus on regulations where the outcome is not focusing on the public interest. That's what we do with national competition policy for the period from 1995 to 2004. Focus on outcomes rather than process. We did that with the EPBC Act review, which is currently hopefully going through Parliament. And the other thing is to strike a balance between efficiency and efficacy. Efficiency, that is to make sure that business can be productive, and efficacy to make sure that it's being effective. The third one, and they will be quick, beware the media, hyperbole and hysteria. What they do is sometimes they'll take a particular action, they'll get hysterical about it and you'll see the hyperbole, and then suddenly politicians react and they want to regulate. Self-help is very important in the regulations. With the EPBC review, we recommended three hierarchy. Granular regulations to be able to say this is what you can and can't do, guidelines to enhance it, and Joe, I am in favour of guidelines. I do think they help. And then rulings, a compendium of rulings, so that you can go back and see what the regulator has done. Fifth one, simplification is not that hard. You know, Ken Hayne actually said, we don't need new laws. What we need is the current laws to be obeyed or to be enforced. And, you know, he summarised them very quickly, but I'll only give you two or three of them. Don't mislead or deceive. It's a remarkable one-line regulation, but it covers so much. Second is make full, meaningful disclosures to people that are going to be affected by your transactions. Just obey and enforce the current laws, and then importantly, and I think Joe raised this before, avoid duplication of regulators and of regulators. And look, I can see so often ministers saying, I'll make my mark by introducing these regulations and a new regulator. And I say, but hold on, you've already got a regulator doing it. What do you need more for? Item six, transparency. It's an unforgiving discipline. It leads to accountability. Let the market work its regulatory wisdom. The market can actually do things so well, particularly if you've got transparency. And the final one is the most important one, I think, in the end. If you want to deter people from breaching the law, put in place interorum penalties. Now, for the non-lawyers, interorum is terrorising penalties, penalties that are so great that you are so afraid to actually run the risk, you just don't do it. And that means, like we did with cartels, jail sentences for the executives concerned. If we're worried about people developing the digital services in a way that might do real harm, then put in place really massive penalties, not just financial, but potentially jail sentences for those that are involved. And suddenly you'll find that people will start to behave themselves.
All right. Good work, Graham. Except for the spray against the media and the regulators, we're feeling okay about those.
I'm feeling the lot.
Okay, good. Joe Masters, is it possible to measure the impact of over-regulation on the Australian economy, or is it perhaps measured in its absence, the absence of productivity growth, perhaps, is it, we're talking about all the time?
Yeah, good question. So undoubtedly, regulation and red tape are important for productivity growth. And in Australia, we have clearly a productivity problem. It varies across sectors. And as you said, calling out construction in particular, where real drags in productivity are hurting not just our economic cycle, but actually the structure of our economy. We've heard a lot in the last day and a half about intergenerational inequality. So we know that it has an impact. We know that I don't think about deregulation, I think about right-sizing regulation. Regulation in and of itself shouldn't be static. Our economy is not static, cyclically or structurally. So we should always be asking ourselves, is the regulation that we have, is it still fit for purpose for the economy that we have today, tomorrow, and in 10 years' time? And the answer to that in many cases will be yes, but in some cases it'll be what's no longer relevant, or it's having unintended consequences, or there's ways we can do it better. So the first thing is we need to right-size regulation, because if you step it back sort of in an economics framework, right? What is regulation trying to achieve? Well, fundamentally, the market generally does a pretty good job of allocating resources, whether that's capital, labour, IP, or anything else in our economy. Generally, it's pretty good, but we know that it has shortcomings at times and in particular parts of our economy. And so we do need to regulate to try to minimise that bad behaviour. But we know every time that we regulate, I always say it has economic friction. There's a cost to doing it, and so we need to make sure that the societal benefit that we're trying to achieve is being achieved, and it's greater than the economic friction or the cost of what we're doing. Simplification, that's just a no-brainer, right? So we know that we need this regulation, and then you just want to do it as efficiently as you can, because that's how you reduce that economic friction, that economic drag. So this is a very long answer to your question, but I'm going to keep going here. So the two things are different. They're both very, very important. Red tape, removal of red tape, is another way of saying simplification, in my mind, has to be one of the easiest productivity levers we can pull. We know tax reform is hard. We know that reskilling our economy takes time. We know infrastructure takes time to build. But red tape, you can change something today. We can change something every day to do what we need to do more efficiently. And so, you know, really commend the regulators in this focus and the simplification process on, let's just get this done easier, faster, not lowering standards, but just doing it with less economic friction. Can we measure it? Look, there's lots of examples around the world where they've tried to measure simplification. British Columbia in Canada is one example where they had quite a simplistic, you know, one in, two out type approach to deregulation, and they definitely reduced their red tape. And there's numbers out there, you know, you can quote billions of dollars over 10 years, but the truth is, I don't know how accurate they are, because deregulation or simplification never occurs in isolation. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, it generally occurs when we're interacting with all sorts of other levers on productivity. So for me, you know, economists have a long list of things, levers we can pull in Australia. We've been talking about them for two decades. They haven't really changed, but red tape has to be the simplest one that we can pull today that will have an impact next week.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Nicola, you were nodding along to a couple of Graham's principles. Is there anything you want to pick up?
So there's a couple. One is, we actually have a remarkably good and robust legal system in this country. We don't repeal laws. We don't repeal regulation. We just add to them. And the thing that I, you know, to Joe's point, if there's one thing we could do, it is to stop contradictory regulation, either within the Commonwealth government, between Commonwealth and states, and between states and states. And, you know, I'll give you an example. We've got outstanding duties and obligations of directors in our Corporations Act. But every time there's an issue, a government, state or federal, will want to bash the directors. So they add another set of obligations over here in another piece of legislation. So workers' compensation, workers' rights, statutory manslaughter. So you then get this huge impact where directors are now subject to an enormous amount of regulation and legislation, when in fact we've got some principles in one act that could cover the field. Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about, and that's why I was nodding to what Joe was saying, because I absolutely agree we could tackle red tape today and tomorrow and next week, and it will have a mess. It will just go to the bottom line. But secondly, I think governments should look at legislation and regulation to repeal what's not necessary anymore. So the stuff that is not fit for purpose, is not fit for a modern economy, is stifling innovation. You know, that list can go on.
Joe, I'm just going to get you to get your microphone adjusted by the gentleman side of stage there.
Sorry.
And Joe Longo, while we're doing that, we've got a real-life working example here of simplification that ASIC has been on, that the ASIC Simplification Consultative Group, which was you set up a year ago about that at this forum.
First meeting. Mine's working.
Is a multi-year program.
Co-chaired with Nicola, by the way.
Yes, Nicola's going to get a few questions about it too. How do you think it's progressing? How do you think it's gone in the first year?
Well, it's exceeded my expectations, actually. At the very beginning, I wanted there to be a diversity of voices on that group. So there are consumer groups, there are industry directors. So that's the first point, that I wanted it to be a broad church. Secondly, there were two key themes. The first is what was in ASIC's gift to deal with, and that turned out to be a lot. And secondly, I think there was some early concern about it, but I wasn't too worried about it, and that was to come up with law reform ideas. But in fairness to everyone involved, including Treasury, who were early supporters of this initiative and were at every meeting, I really appreciate that. So two themes: what was in ASIC's gift and what ideas could we get on law reform. It turned out that what was in ASIC's gift was a lot. And I've mentioned forms and statutory instruments, regulatory guidance, a whole range, a lot of small business deals with ASIC, those interactions are often not very positive. Our website needed modernisation. There was just a lot we could do. So I think the first big message for ASIC, and indeed for all regulators, is to look to your own house, look to yourself. Are you making things worse than they needed to be, harder than they need to be? Are you introducing complexity and frictions that just aren't necessary? That's the first thing. And some nice law reform ideas came through, and we're feeding those through to Treasury, and we published a report a couple of months ago now where some of those ideas have been floated. But as I said this morning, what I personally find very dismaying is we're just not good at self-correction. We've got to get a grip on that issue. We're a federal system, I accept that, and we have to take our political and constitutional arrangements. But even so, we've got to do better than we are now, and I've got some ideas on that.
Okay, we might come back to that. Nicola, pretend Joe's not here. We'll do a bit of a 365-degree feedback session. As the chair of the committee, how have you found it, and sort of what has been the friction points that have been really, exposed by the committee's work?
So when Joe asked me to co-chair the project with him 12 months ago, I thought, from my background, it was something that I could do and it would be, positive. But the thing I would say is there are two very big surprises I've had. One is the willingness of ASIC and also Treasury to embrace the whole concept of simplification. I don't think I can emphasise strongly enough just the enthusiasm from the regulator that there's a lot we can do to simplify what we do. But the second more important thing, which was a real surprise to me, was the huge goodwill from the whole of the Australian economy. And because of the way the project was set up, we included all parts of the economy. So, the BCA, so big business, small business, those organisations that look after consumers, those organisations that look after law reform, so the Law Council, professors of corporate professors at university. Everybody approached the project with this huge amount of goodwill, and that's why we got. I think both ASIC, I certainly was surprised, but so were the other people who were involved, just by the huge number of really positive suggestions that sort of got fed into the suggestion box. And then the next surprise to me was I kept urging Joe and the team, get some quick wins, do something fast, because then you can then build on that. And I thought when I issued that challenge that it would take a long time, and it didn't, because the website was actually updated and modernised relatively quickly. Now, to be fair, there was a lot of work that had been done for a long time, but it was interesting how it just accelerated stuff being done. The thing I was surprised about was just the friction points for small business, lodging forms, needing wet signatures, having to go to the post office to fax something. I mean, who uses a fax machine these days? There's probably one in Sydney. So understanding where those friction points were and then just removing them. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Going to a point where, ASIC will get to electronic lodgement with electronic signatures, and that will make life easier. And it goes to my point about the definition of simplification. Simplify what you're doing. Make it easier for people to work with you. And that's been the biggest surprise in the 12 months that I've been involved, is just the number of ideas, the huge goodwill, but then what ASIC's been able to achieve.
Yeah. Graham, I know you said at the start your first principle was be careful about asking a regulator, are the regulations right? But does this model that ASIC's been pursuing, the Simplification Committee, perhaps provide a bit of a model we could use in other places?
It does indeed, James, but the culture starts at the top. And I'm going to pay a compliment to Joe on this, because I know Joe's attitude, and it's infused down into the organisation with almost a clear instruction. We've got to simplify it. We've got to bring about a change. I'm not sure that exists in all regulators. And you have a problem where the culture at the top says regulate for risk, not regulate for growth. The other problem, of course, is that changes to the corporations law and to the competition law, etc., have to go through Treasury. And I'm not sure that the culture, certainly back when I was chair of the ACCC, the culture was right there in terms of simplification. So let me give you a very simple example. We got the government at last to agree that cartel conduct, price fixing in particular, would be subject to criminal penalties. It seemed to me fairly easy to do. Put one line in the Act that said an extra line of penalty, jail up to 10 years on a criminal prosecution. We all knew what a cartel was. We knew what price fixing was. We'd had successful prosecutions. Visi was the one that Sarah mentioned before. So it was all there. Wasn't good enough for Treasury. 62 pages of extra legislation we introduced to define criminal cartel conduct. Now, it just seemed to me to be, you know, an overkill for something that could have been done quite easily. And I've seen other situations. So you've got to have the tone at the top starting correctly with the regulator, and I congratulate Joe for what he's done there. You've then got to have the right attitude in the department, and then I have to say the right attitude amongst the politicians to be able to accept it. That's an awful lot of people to put together.
Yeah. I mean, are there past attempts at deregulation and reform that give us, you know, a bit of guidance as to how this can work or how you can get it right?
Well, there's been past attempts, all of which have failed. So that'll tell you, if you look at the failures, that'll tell you how it ought to be done. Yeah, one of the worst of them is the one that says we're going to deregulate to the extent of X percent, the quantitative ones that I've talked about. That's just stupid. That's a silly political bit of nonsense. And fortunately, current government hasn't said that. So what they did was they said we're going to have the economic roundtable, it was going to be a productivity roundtable. It was about efficiency. It was about looking at regulation, the way that Joe's been doing it with ASIC, and to say how can we simplify things and remove what I call the gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers are those that are there to stop you doing things that are efficient or are pro-competition. So, you know, a very simple one that we've got, but unfortunately the Commonwealth can't do anything about it, is in terms of land development. And you might want to talk about increasing competition with supermarkets and the like, but when NIMBY reigns, local councils reigns, state governments just won't deal with permission of development, then you've got a problem. They're the gatekeepers. Now, that's been there. We did a supermarket report back at the ACCC in 2008. I remember Craig Emerson, the minister at the time, saying, one of your big recommendations, Graham, is to change the land development rules. He said, I'm going to fix it. I said, good luck, Craig. You got no chance. And he had no chance. And successive ministers tried it. Treasurer Chalmers has said he's going to fix it. I wish him luck. I think it'll be beyond him.
Yeah. Nicola, the three levels of government don't seem to make our life easy in this deregulation efforts, do they?
No, they don't. They don't, because there's so much duplication. There's a lot of duplication between federal and state, and I think we know that. But there's increasing duplication between local government and state, and even local government and federal. And I think we need to recognise the way that Australia's been set up as a country, but make it work. And I think to Graham's point, successive state and federal governments have tried to do that, but in certain industries, it's just very, very hard. Land development, land use, the whole permission to build, the permission to renovate, all of that is really hard. And when you know, if you look at big infrastructure, for example, and this country actually does infrastructure really well. We're one of the few countries that when we say we're going to build something, we actually go ahead and build it, and we've got some great examples. But why I'm bringing that to everyone's attention is, for infrastructure, the governments do seem to get it right and take much more control of the whole usage issue, the way that land is acquired, all of that sort of stuff. But we don't seem to be able to do it where we need to do it, like in building residential housing.
Yeah.
That's a mess.
Yeah. Well, I often say, like, we call these things, and maybe it's people like me who call them, we call them crises, and then we don't really have a crisis-like attitude to them, do we?
We have the burning platform, we know it's there, and then we go, oh, let's call the fire brigade, but then they put the fire out, but we don't learn from it and then build from it.
So I'm going to put Prime Minister Wakefield Evans or President Wakefield Evans on the spot here. Which level of government are we getting rid of? We won't tell anyone outside this room.
I wouldn't get rid of any level of government, but I think we need to step back and reallocate who is responsible for what, and it's got to be done for the whole of Australia. You can't do it in, like, some states have tried. Mm. Some states have removed local councils, amalgamated them to some success. Others have not been successful. I'm not necessarily talking about removing levels of government. We need to make them work better for Australia's prosperity. And that means sitting back and understanding who does what. And also, I think, leadership from the federal government and then the state governments. Because the federal government's a long way removed from local government.
True. Joe Masters, Graham mentioned the Economic Reform Roundtable. It seems like a distant memory in some ways because so much has happened this year. But it was part of a sort of moment, I think. You know, we had, what did the UK have? They had the bonfire of regulation, I think it was called. And obviously Trump has had the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which has got deregulatory elements to it. Mm-hmm. Do we need to keep up with the international Joneses here and chase this deregulation target as on a sort of global level?
So I think we need to chase red tape reduction. I think we need to chase, as I said, I'm not so into, I don't think about deregulation, I think about right-sizing our regulation, and Nicola talked about some of that. But I don't know that our goal should be what our global peers are necessarily doing. But our economy is fundamentally different from any of those that you mentioned, and some of the problems we have, some are similar. Construction, actually, residential construction is one that is quite similar to the UK issues, but they're very different. So we want to make sure that we've got an Australian objective, an Australian context around it. Mm. And that objective is pretty simple, right? At the moment, productivity growth is so weak in this country that our standard of living is going backwards. And if we are not careful, we are going to have childless cities. Just imagine that for a moment. And we're going to be a generation that leave our grandchildren with a lower standard of living. That's an appalling place to be. So this is actually really important. In terms of the global element, I'd make two comments. The first one is, I think we can learn from offshore, and that can be what not to do and what we can do. So we should be quick adopters of good policy that works offshore, or quick adopters of good policy that's working in different states, to come back to Nicola's point. So that's the first one. The second one is, I think we need to think, you know, we're in a very globalised world, even though it's more fragmented. We're a small, open, trading nation. Global capital markets are reallocating in a global sense, not in a nationalistic sense anymore. We heard about superannuation funds earlier today. So I guess when I think about the global perspective of this session, one thing I think about is we're doing what we're doing over here and the UK is doing what they're doing here and the US is doing here. Are we thinking about what is our regulatory bridge? So if we think about global capital allocation, are we thinking about how our regulatory changes and reforms are making it easier in a global context, not just in a local context? And I think that is really important.
Yeah, that's a great point. Graham, I'm going to get you to address Bradley's question here. How do we get greater alignment between the states on laws to simplify life for those business working across jurisdictions? Or should we just abolish the states, except for Sheffield Shield cricket and State of Origin football?
Well, there's far more important, of course, which is the national AFL competition, which is... Now, look, we actually have had alignment, and it brings me to the whole issue of the competition policy that we had starting in 1995 and 94 following the Hilmer Report. And there we got all the states and territories to agree with the Commonwealth on a whole program of national competition policy reform. Now, Treasurer Chalmers has actually said that he wants to have a 2.0 of that because it's very important. But we got the states aligned. What we said to them was, we will give you $16 billion if you agree to do these reforms. I thought it was a mistake actually to promise it up front, because they put in their forward estimates, and then I had to be the unfortunate person that said to them, you haven't complied with your obligations, therefore you're going to be penalised. And that was wrong. But yeah, what I think the Treasurer is now doing is he's saying to himself, I can get alignment between the states by saying to them, do the following. If you agree to do it, you'll get paid. If you don't want to do it, that's fine. It saves me some money and you won't get the money, right? And national competition policy strikes me as being fundamentally, you know, a foundation stone of this whole process, particularly in terms of productivity. See, with NCP, you know, point or stage one, we reviewed over 2,000 regulations throughout the Commonwealth. And what we did with those regulations is to say, are they anti-competitive? And if they are, can they be justified in the public interest? Underline the word public interest. Very, very important. Now, we got most of those covered, and some of the obvious ones were shop trading hours and things of this nature. But there's a whole lot of them there now that are still there. They are the gatekeepers to greater productivity. And so there's a real agenda that's there for the Treasurer to say to the states, sign up to this in principle. I'm not offering to pay you any money yet, but as we look at each one, and the PC will be able to advise, Productivity Commission will be able to advise what are the most productivity-enhancing regulations that could be removed or that could be dealt with, and let it take that course. Then I think you've got a way of getting all the states to work together. But one of the principles that the Treasurer will have to lay down is to say, Victoria, if you do that, right, that's going to be out of line with New South Wales, Queensland, Western Australia, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to get paid, so fall into line. Carried and that's a way of doing it.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in on that? Yeah. Because you asked about you started about the National Economic Roundtable.
Yes.
And one of the things, perhaps the most important thing that came out of that in my mind, is the Treasurer managed to wrangle a whole group of stakeholders and find out what do we commonly agree on. And I think when you're trying to bring alignment, the starting point is where do we have commonality? And to Nicola's point about the simplification process, therefore, what is a quick win that you can get that demonstrates we are working together and there are things that we can do that aren't, they're hard, but they're not impossibly hard. And I think that was a real win out of that roundtable.
But where are the quick wins, though? Sorry, you go, Nicola.
We've done harmonisation between state laws really well in this country. There are some of us up here who remember the harmonisation of the corporate laws in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It is an exception, but it was very valuable.
Long list here.
We also harmonised the stock exchanges. We went from state stock exchanges to one stock exchange. We did that really well, and then we sort of got lost because there was a whole list, I remember as a young lawyer, of where the states and the federal government were going to harmonise laws. We go back to that list, get a quick win. I'd start with probably workplace laws because at the moment you've got every state and the federal government with very complex workplace laws, and I'm not saying deregulate, but if you harmonise them and we have the same structure, both federal and state, then it will make employers' lives easier, but not reducing the obligations.
Joe?
And national licensing in the construction space.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an
national
easy
licensing.
One.
Joe's got a list he's going to go.
I've got a long list. Many of you will not remember the model criminal code committee from the mid-1990s, and we were all supposed to be operating under one criminal law. Remember that good old day?
Yep.
So in 2001, we got the Criminal Code Act, and only one entity in the Commonwealth adopted it. That was the Northern Territory. So we have a federal criminal code, and then we have codes in Queensland, Tasmania, Western Australia. We have the non-code states. So on the humble subject of criminal law, even on the humble subject of the age of criminal responsibility, we can't get a national agreement on. So the criminal law, forget it. The law of evidence remains inconsistent. The law of defamation, people have had some experience there, and different states have different approaches. And then there's the whole idea of cooperative federalism. Anyone who had any hope in that, for all of us who lived through COVID, those days were long gone. Everyone, so I think this is a really difficult problem. Putting that to one side, I'm not an advocate for rearranging the constitutional arrangement of the Commonwealth. I think we should all be realistic. But I think what we should be thinking about are actionable opportunities for fixing problems. And so my big mantra is we need to choose two or three big problems, set up a task force and solve each one. And that has to be bipartisan and constitutionally sensitive to our arrangements. Because what we're doing now simply isn't working. So my basic point is we just keep doing what we're doing now. Argue with one another and all the rest of it. But it's not actually solving the problem. And so my view is we have to figure out, we have strong institutions, we got to create a new one, an institutional self-correction mechanism. And in the humble world, word of corporate law, that's why I'm supporting the return of a CAMAC. We've had several Australian Law Reform Commission reports on trying to fix the Corporations Act, comprehensively ignored. We have a corporate law economic reform program, humbly called CLERP, remember CLERP? In the 90s and the early 2000s. We can solve these problems, but we've got to get ourselves organised, you know.
Graham, is a CAMAC a good idea?
Yeah. I don't think we'll ever get cooperative federalism. What we might do is competitive federalism. And competitive federalism really means saying, I'll pick the states off one by one. Now, it's interesting that Minister Murray Watt's doing that in relation to the EBBC review, the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act review. So what he's saying is to Western Australia, he's been quite public, I'll enter into an agreement with you to provide for efficiency for your business community and efficacy in terms of the Act, right? And you could be the first one. And then someone else is going to turn around, probably Queensland, and say, well, if you can do it there, perhaps we can do it here, but it'll be the same rules, right? And then New South Wales will have to say, we'll do it as well. So it's the competitive process that might actually work. So first it's that. The second element of it is actually providing a benefit. And the benefit that Minister Watt is providing to the states is to say, I will give business in those states the benefit of efficiency, but you've got to give me in return a set of rules relating to the environment that are going to be work efficacy.
Yeah, okay. So that's a competitive federalism rather than cooperative federalism. Is there a model that has both?
Do it that way. I mean, that's why Delaware attracts all the incorporations. But that's there's a whole literature around that about race at the bottom. So there are. I take your point, Graham. I think there's a lot in it. The other thing I just want to bring out, which is, we're talking about deregulation, we're cutting red tape, but we have limited resources. Our problem-solving skills aren't great. But one thing we're certainly not good at is measuring the benefits. And so one of the things I think about a lot, and we've talked about at various meetings, is in a world of limited resources, which regulations or what practice, if I do that, how do I measure the beneficial impact of that? And there is no compelling paradigm to do that. And if you really think about it a lot, that in and of itself is a problem, because if you've got 50 problems to solve, you want to solve the three or four that are going to make the most difference. But you're not going to know what's going to make the most difference if you can't measure the beneficial impact. And equally, there's an emotional component to it. The problems people think are big problems because they feel that way may rationally not be evidence-based. We're looking at the wrong problems to solve. So I think that's another issue for us, to figure out what do we want to solve, why do we want to solve it.
Joe Masters, you've been doing a lot of work around AI recently. Is there a productivity benefit here that's going to perhaps, you know, improve the economic growth such that we can worry less about deregulation and simplification?
I think you want to deregulate and simplify anyway, because you'll get a known productivity lift. You might not know how big it is, but we know that it works and we know that it matters. AI, I mean, we could spend 2 days on AI, right? Ultimately, what will AI do? Let's talk about technology more broadly, right? Technology will replace some jobs, that is true. For most jobs, though, our research shows in Australia, 2 out of 3 jobs will actually be augmented rather than substituted. And I think that point often gets lost, because generally when I talk to people, they think that most of our workforce are miners and construction workers, and that's actually not true. So that's the first thing. We're actually in an economy that's wired for augmentation rather than replacement by tech. And augmentation, ultimately, what does that do? It makes us more productive. So we will get a productivity boost, but the real magic will be if we can take the time that it gives each person back and do something productive with that time. So you've kind of got 2 paths. You can make everyone more productive and you'll have unproductive time from very smart people, whether they're unemployed or they're just doing, you know, menial task, or they're not working full time, or whatever that might be. But really, as a nation, what do we want to do? We want to augment, and then we want you to use that time to do something that builds productivity, because that's how we're going to improve our standard of living and the opportunities for new and young Australians. And I think actually in the regulatory space, there's real opportunity. I talked about that bridge with sort of the global regulator to regulator, but there's also a bridge in how we do our regulation here in Australia. So we know that one of the first adoptions of AI generally in corporate Australia is how can I improve my processes and my surveillance and my reporting, and those processes are pretty well advanced with AI. And then we're hearing, you know, regulators are doing the same thing. How can we use AI to automate our more manual things? Are we ensuring that those two buckets have a bridge? Because, again, that's where you supercharge your productivity. This is more productive, this is more productive. But the sort of 1+1=3 is when you have that bridge.
Yeah. Graham, are we going to need new AI regulations?
Oh, heaven's sake, no. look, I was so pleased you've asked that question, James, because it gives me a chance to rant again about my bête noire, the ACCC. So they've produced 5 years of reports, and they want new regulations to deal with AI and digital services. I have to say to you, by the way, that contrary to Rod Sims, I'm pleased that the Treasurer seems to be indicating he's defunding the massive expertise they had in the ACCC. I don't think it's actually shown itself to be terribly productive in terms of what it's producing. But let me look at it this way, and I'll tell you the discussion I had with the ACCC on this. We have laws that prohibit misleading and deceptive conduct. We have laws that prohibit breaches of copyright. We have laws that prohibit breaches of privacy. We have laws that breach a whole range of things, you know, all around Australia, right? And so my response to the ACCC in its report, because what he wants to do is to have ex ante laws, that is laws that will get you beforehand, and they're guardrails as to how we should behave with AI. So I said, well, look, I don't care if someone misleads and deceives by the use of a quill pen or by the use of a computer or by the use of ChatGPT. It's all the same. It's going to, and it might have more raging effects if they use social media. But the result is the same. They are misleading and deceiving, so we ought to stop them. ACCC's response to me is to say it's too hard because Google is going to put a lot of money into it and is going to take 10 years to enforce the law. I say, well, the two things I would do. First of all, I'd say to you, concentrate on enforcing the law instead of trying to dream up new laws. And they've done it with Microsoft. So, you know, these people are not so big that they can't be tackled. And the second thing is, goes back to what I said before, introduce interim penalties such that Google says and its directors say, oops, we better not try this on, because if we do, we run the risk of going to jail. And it worked with cartels. It's been very interesting. One of the assistant deputy attorney general, whatever it might have been, back in the administration when we introduced criminal cartel conduct, and he said, I have never known an executive say to me, I will spend a month in jail rather than paying a financial penalty. Yeah. So, you know, make it count and make the risk-benefit analysis work very much in favour of, I won't do it. The risk is too great.
Nicola, you must be talking about AI around the board table all the time. Mm. Does the conversation move into regulatory boundaries and potential regulatory traps?
So it's an interesting conversation because it's both how will AI assist and innovate, you know, company by company. How can we use it for the better, for our customers, for making processes simpler? I agree with Joe. I mean, in no company that I'm on the board of, although I do know that there are others that have done this, are our employees at risk of AI. We very positively see AI as augmenting most roles and also allowing some roles to be freed up so that employees or executives can do something else. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. There is an underlying concern, though, that, again, there will be a whole raft of legislation which will make directors liable for the use of AI by the companies. And I want to say one thing. Directors actually can't use AI over board papers because companies don't want to run the risk of having, you know, we're not allowed to use ChatGPT, so I can't put any of my board papers through a third-party provider, and we don't have access to the internal AI because we're not on the company systems. So there's a big debate at the moment by directors around we need to actually quite quickly go up the curve and understand how AI operates. And I would say I think that's where the director community has done really well. Like all the directors I know are educating themselves, going to courses, a lot of going overseas to do courses to really understand, you know, trips to Google, going to Google here in Melbourne and in Sydney to actually understand. But at the end of the day, we're exposed a little bit by having the prospect of increasing regulation and obligations put on us on how the companies use it, but also being left behind on how it is used and understanding its value and benefits.
As a solution for the to allow directors to eventually be able to, you know, benefit from AI summarise board papers or?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, what a lot of companies are doing are asking the company secretary to put the board papers through the internal AI, and that's been very effective. So I think it's a watch this space, but at the moment there's a bit of tension. Mm.
Joe, do you see the opportunity for regulators to use AI to simplify and, you know, find those little pain points that are that you know, the simplification committee's done lots of work, but I'm sure there's a million other documents you could go through and start attacking things?
Well, there is an analogous journey that we're going through at ASIC as well. Over half our staff use Copilot. And I've been encouraging the use and understanding of AI throughout the commission and agency. We are great consumers and gatherers of data. And so we get data from AFCA, from reports of misconduct, from IDR, EDR, from all sorts of sources. And so it's just such an obvious opportunity to use those kinds of technologies to analyse that data and draw inferences from it. And that can, it's all the obvious things. It can inform, you know, what are the three or four themes coming out. It could inform a surveillance. It could inform the commencement of an investigation. It also informs just what's going on. You know, the data can tell you things that may not be readily apparent. We're also using these technologies to, we've run some internal pilots. We're a great consumer of submissions. And so we've run some pilots where we get thousands of pages of submissions. We run it through a large language model and see, and we're seeing the quality of what comes out is improving. The courts are grappling with this. We've been working, some of our people have been invited to a couple of court federal court and state Supreme Court conferences where the judges are grappling with this very issue. Some of the stories are quite notorious, have been in the newspapers about submissions hallucinating about existence, about cases that don't exist, and the lawyers getting themselves into trouble. So I think all of that's happening at ASIC at the moment. The other thing from my perspective is we really need to get on top of these technologies because they're being used by our regulated population, and we need to build internal capability. So when things go wrong or we suspect misconduct, that very often the mechanism or the, what's the right phrase, the way that misconduct is happening might be, like for example, we've heard a lot about agentic AI. It's going to get pretty blurry out there as to where the misconduct was. That a human or was that a bot or something in between? So I think we're building capability in that area as well.
Yeah. Graham, coming back to the Economic Reform Roundtable, I think you made the point that some quick wins out of that would have been great to see. Has the momentum stalled a bit there, do you think?
You just don't know, because there was a lot of discussion leading up to the roundtable and for a day or so afterwards, but we haven't heard any more since. Is there a quick win? Well, I go back to what I said before. Competition policy is a very quick win. It's easy to implement. I say easy to implement. It's easy to start it.
Yep.
and to move it along. And it's a matter of some pretty crafty negotiations by Treasury stroke the Treasurer with individual states. And it will gather its own momentum through, as I say, competitive federalism. So you know, it's there. It's able to be done. Unfortunately, what happened was, and I think it was, perhaps a bit of a slip of the tongue by the Treasurer in a speech he gave when he introduced tax into the fold. And of course, the moment you introduce tax, you're in a hiding for nothing, because every vested interest comes out there and says, reduce the taxes that apply to my business, and all the others say, and what about mine? And then in the end, you've got no tax for anyone at all. Can I just make one quick comment about AI? Because
sure.
It just occurred to me. There's one really grave risk that we do run, which we can deal with if we recognise it, and it's Skynet. It's the Terminator Skynet. It's the machine. Now, people will laugh and say, oh, yeah, that's just Hollywood. It is there when a trillionaire says, and I use the word trillionaire on purpose, when a trillionaire says, I am more powerful and far more relevant to the world, and my views are far more relevant than any elected government, and I'm going to develop a computer that will essentially control all elements of the world, including the stock exchanges, maybe the armed forces and the like. That's when you start to have a problem. How do you stop it? You recognise it up front and you put the trillionaire in jail.
Does the trillionaire need to do anything wrong? I mean...
Well, it's the moment you get a sense that the trillionaire is heading along that path that you say, enough, stop. And then you do it. Now, alternatively, you bring in Arnie, and Arnie comes in there with his...
Well, I didn't think we'd bring up Mr. Schwarzenegger on this panel, Joe. We've got about...
His movies were a very significant contribution
to
contemporary culture.
Yeah.
And he went on to be a governor of California.
Perhaps in your valedictory speech in a couple of months, you can say, I'll be back.
I think that's a stretch, right?
Fair enough. All right, I'm going to ask everybody to come up with a great idea. In the spirit of keeping things simple, as simplification is an important principle of this panel, what single principle should guide Australia's next cycle of regulatory reform? Graham, you're going to go last because you'll have to narrow it down. Joe, you can go first.
We need to find a principle that will figure out which three key problems are going to reduce complexity and reduce burden on business in a measurable way, where people say, OK, I'm prepared to take the risk and get behind that. Because at the moment, we're really good at highlighting problems and issues, but we do not have an institutionalised will to do it. So I think if we come up with two or three good problems to solve, then all else will follow.
So prioritisation, confidence building.
That's right.
Yeah. Nicole?
I would go for prosperity. So, you know, what can we do to enhance the prosperity of Australia and Australians? I'm like Joe, I really worry about childless cities, about my children and my grandchildren not being able to afford to live in cities, not being able to afford to live near where they work. And I also think we need to have a much more whole of Australia approach. We get too much down into our silos, whether they're sector silos, government silos, corporation silos, city silos. I think we all just need to take a step up and ask ourselves, what can we do to add to the prosperity of this country, and what are the three quick wins that will do that?
Love it. Joe?
Nicola stole my prosperity line. can I extend that? I'm going to run with just do it. We've been just doing it in terms of adding regulation, Band-Aid. We need to flip that and go, just do it. Let's get rid of what we don't need. Let's make what we do need simpler. Just do it. Easy wins. You can find 1,000 easy wins, and over time you'll build momentum towards a reform mindset and a reform culture.
Graham?
Ask in respect of every existing regulation and every new regulation, what's the outcome intended, and is it in the public interest? And if the outcome is in the public interest, go ahead. If it's not, then just don't do it. Think again.
Have we done that, though, already? I mean, you were talking, you went through 2,000 regulations with that exact fine-tooth comb.
Oh, yeah, but since then we've had, what did we finish, 2004? So we've had all those years, 20 years... where we've just layered on more and more and more regulations. often in response to hysterical outbursts, not by the Financial Review, but by,
of course,
some of the more tabloid newspapers, and we get this every day. In this state, we're seeing it every day, you know, and suddenly we've got life sentences for young children because they're involved in home invasions. But maximum penalties for rape is 25 years. I just find the whole thing is incongruous. But anyway, that's that gets that one off the chest. But, I mean, it is really, you know, I do think it's important that we say to ourselves, is this regulation outcome-oriented or process? If it's outcome, important. If it's process, then think again. And the second thing is that outcome in the public interest, not in a vested, in pursuit of a vested interest?
Fantastic. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a great panel. We've covered a lot of ground from the Terminator to all the way back to Skynet. So thank you very much for listening to our great panel. And will you please thank our panellists, Joe, Nicola, Joe and Graham.